is Common Sense Radio. Straightforward and no excuses.
All right. Come on now.
This is the Steve Gruber Show.
Call me crazy.
Ooh, yeah.
What I said was perfectly right and spot on accurate.
Boy's got a mouth like a cannon, always shooting it all.
Stop. Yeah, stop. I mean, you're way off script.
Got it in me. Gonna quit until it all comes out.
Hey, boy.
Yeah, you know, it's not cynical, it's common sense.
Pay attention to me when I'm talking to you.
I'm gonna rock the nation.
Genuine, accountable, and raw. Here is Steve Gruber.
It's 6 after the hour, and this hour of the Steve Gruber Show is brought to you by Mesa Good Health, Good Business, and Great Schools. I'm Katie Hyde from the Michigan Talk Network, wrapping up the... We're not wrapping up. We're just getting started. It's Friday. Rob Burkhart, the producer, he's been in the studio with me all week, and he's been keeping me on target here. And Ivy Gruber, our producer, and of course, Alex Clark, our engineer. And certainly the show would not be possible without them. And Steve makes it look easy when he's on the air. He has so much great stuff to say and great points of view, but it could not be possible without the group that works behind the scenes. So I am just grateful for them. They've made me look good all week. With the tradition of the show, we're going to continue with our free-for-all Friday. That's when you call in with your comments or your opinion. No topic required. We're not going to tell you can't talk about something. We just want to hear from you. Our number to the hotline here, 888-900-9966. Again, that number is 888-900-9966. We'd love to hear from you. And I know you have stuff on your mind, so give us a call. Let's take a look at some of the news that's happening overnight. With the holidays fast approaching, we've got 7 days until Christmas, if you can believe that. If you haven't done your shopping, make sure you get it done. But with the holidays and Christmas fast approaching, the events of San Bernardino and Paris are on everyone's mind. And even with the premiere of the new Star Wars film and crowded theaters where people are, what some say, sitting ducks for Mad Men, the thought of terrorist violence certainly running through our minds. On Thursday, President Barack Obama said that the U.S. intelligence and counterterrorism officials don't have any specific credible information that suggests a potential terrorist attack against the U.S. during the holidays. And this is what the president had to say.
At this moment, our intelligence and counterterrorism professionals do not have any specific and credible information about an attack on the homeland. That said, we have to be vigilant. As I indicated in my address to the nation last week, we are in a new phase of terrorism, including lone actors and small groups of terrorists, like those in San Bernardino. Because they are smaller, often self-initiating, self-motivating, they're harder to detect, and that makes it harder to prevent. We're stepping up our efforts to prevent attacks here at home. As I said, the NCTC is constantly sharing information with our state and local partners. Across the country, more than 100 joint terrorism task forces are the action arm of this fight. Federal, state, and local experts all working together to disrupt threats. At the state level, fusion cells are receiving tips and pushing information out to local law enforcement. And finally, one of our greatest weapons against terrorism is our own strength and resilience as a people. Now, that means staying vigilant. If you see something suspicious, say something to law enforcement. It also means staying united as one American family, remembering that our greatest allies in this fight are each other, Americans of all faiths and all backgrounds. And when Americans stand together, nothing can beat us.
President Barack Obama. On yesterday's edition of the Steve Gruber Show, we interviewed Congressman Tim Walberg from Michigan's 7th District, and today we spoke with Representative Bill Huizenga as well. Both mentioned the budget bill passed in the House earlier this week didn't have everything in it that they had hoped. In fact, Speaker Paul Ryan did say that they didn't get everything that they wanted, but he did praise parts of the $1.1 trillion tax and spending bills that would prevent a government shutdown, but he did call the bill a bipartisan compromise. Let's hear from him.
You know I don't like this process, right? I mean, you know that we inherited a process, a cake that was pretty much more than half baked. I don't like the way that these bills come together because I think we should do these separately, individually, through what we call regular order. That's why I just started this press conference saying next year We're going to do things differently. Next year, when we have a fresh start, we're doing things differently because I don't think this is the way that we should be governing. But we are where we are, and we have a bipartisan compromise where, by the way, I think we've got some good wins. And look, Democrats won some things, too. That's the nature of bipartisan compromises. And so the way I look at this is we have made the best of the situation we have. There are some really good wins in here for the American people. There are very good wins in here for the economy, for job creators, for taxpayers. There are some important developments in here that will help us build a confident America. But as Congress works in the new year, I want to make sure that we get back to what is called regular order so that we have a system that operates like the founders intended. And I feel very good that we're getting off on that good start next year.
Speaker of the House Paul Ryan, an Iowa radio host, is under fire for his tweet during Tuesday night's debate. He did apologize, but his initial words said that Carly Fiorina goes full, quote, V word during debate, unquote. The host is a noted Ted Cruz supporter. Carly Fiorina talked to Fox News' Megyn Kelly about being attacked for a woman while running for president.
Well, I've been called the B word, so now I guess I'm going to be called the V word. What's amazing to me is I told an American story last night in my opening comments. I told my story, just like every other candidate has told their story. Mm-hmm. So it's inexplicable to me why this major surrogate of Ted Cruz thought that was playing the V card. But the more important point is this. This gentleman is more than a radio show talk host. He is a major surrogate for Ted Cruz and a major endorser. And this is why Ted Cruz cannot possibly beat Hillary Clinton.
Well, because, I mean, is he responsible for everything his surrogates say?
Well, this is a major member of Ted Cruz's campaign. Ted Cruz relies on him to speak for him. In fact, he was speaking for Ted Cruz last night. So this is the Cruz campaign. And I think we need to be realistic about what we're going to face with Hillary Clinton.
You know, you have something in common with her in that regard. And that's probably the only thing. That will probably conclude the list of things you have in common. But she's going through some sexist attacks, and we'll go through more. And you are, too. And I know viewers, they don't want to hear it. It's like, okay, whatever. Everybody's got their troubles. But it is a recurring theme.
Well, yes. Look, I believe in meritocracies. I will never ask for people's support because I'm a woman. I will ask for people's support. I believe I'll be the nominee because I think the more people hear, the more they realize I am the most qualified candidate to beat Hillary Clinton and to become president of the United States.
Because you're strong, because you're fiery, not because you're actually
a woman. I'm very proud to be a woman, and 53% of our nation are women.
Carly Fiorina speaking to Megyn Kelly on Fox News. There's an interesting Michigan tie to this story. According to his Facebook page, this radio host attended Grand Rapids Community College, and apparently he apologized because his wife gave him a hard time over what he tweeted. It's 8:14. I'm Katie Hyde from the Michigan Talk Network, filling in here for Steve Gruber. This hour brought to you by Mesa. Good health, good business, and great schools. You're listening to The Steve Gruber Show.
Taking a closer look at the stories that affect you most with a big dose of common sense.
Every day I get in the queue. To get on the bus that takes me to you. I'm so nervous I just sit and smile.
Good morning. It's 8:18. You are listening to Michigan Talk Network's Katie Hyde filling in this week on the Steve Gruber Show. This hour is brought to you by Mesa. Good health, good business, and great schools. The nation has now effectively achieved the long-sought goal of energy independence, not because of any federal program or policies, but because of the efforts of thousands of entrepreneurs deploying new technologies in America's shale fields. With overall dependence on oil imports has decreased from a peak of 60% of consumption back in 2005 to 40% today. That fact doesn't fully convey the new reality. If imports from Canada and Mexico, our North American partners, are taken out of this formula of dependence, then the U.S. reliance on overseas sources of oil is now below 20% of demand. And here to break this down for us is Mark Mills. He joins us on the line. He's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, is the CEO of the Digital Power Group, and he's a faculty fellow at Northwestern's McCormick School of Engineering and Applied Science. Mark, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning, Mark. And I have to tell you, I went to the Medill School there at Northwestern, too. So go Wildcats.
Excellent. Good for you. Great school.
Thank you. Tell me about some of these new technologies that were mentioned in the article.
Well, the key is that everyone calls it the short form. Engineers are very bad at creating short form words. You know, calling it fracking sounds very frightening. But in fact, what's going on is a kind of manufacturing technique has been developed over the last decade to, in effect, create oil out of shale rock. I mean, it's quite remarkable. It's not just, you know, poke a hole in the ground, oil gushes up. It's a technique that involves information technology and imaging, robotic kind of steerable drilling and control systems, and, of course, using high-pressure water to sort of stimulate the so-called fracture, stimulate rock, shale, to release oil and gas. What's interesting is these shale fields have been known for 100 years by geologists. They're not discovered. What we discovered in the last decade is the technology to release oil and gas from it, and it's called source rock. I mean, this form of oil and gas, for all practical purposes, is practically infinite in supply. I mean, it's a stunning amount of energy available to the United States.
And how is this going to impact us in the years to come?
Well, basically, it means we're entered an era of what I would call serial gluts instead of serial shortages. Or, for economic terms, it means that the price of oil is effectively, you know, absent, you know, wars and those kinds of things. But it's effectively what economists call range-bound. It's going to stay pretty cheap for a long time, which is, you know, wonderful news for consumers. And it's, I think, excellent news for America because we can produce it at low prices. We're the ones that caused the price to go down in the first place in America.
And why do you think the phrase fracking gets so much bad press, or why are people so afraid of that?
You know, this is a line, or, you know, I could say I'm not a psychologist, so I don't.
But just your opinion.
It's odd. It's an odd thing because there's been a disinformation campaign put in play by, I guess the only way you could put it is by people who just don't like oil and gas, who used to think we were running out of it, so I felt pretty happy about that, because they wanted things other than oil and gas. And now that there's a glut of oil and gas because of fracking, there's a lot of opposition. Look, it's like any industrial process. It's a big industry which employs millions of people. It involves thousands of companies in the United States. This is not big oil. This is about small, mid-sized businesses, thousands of them. The big oil industry has only produced 25% of America's oil and gas. Small and mid-sized businesses produce 75%. So this attack on fracking is kind of an attack on American small business. And, you know, the idea that's put out is that somehow it's endangering water supplies because it uses a lot of water to fracture the rock. The truth is every state EPA that studied this, and then many have, has found no evidence of any kind of sustained contamination of water and drinking water. It simply just doesn't happen. It doesn't happen for a lot of reasons, but it doesn't happen. So, you know, it's a kind of disinformation that goes on when people have other agendas. And their agenda is not so much that they don't like fracking per se. It's that they don't like oil and gas being cheap and abundant.
Well, it's refreshing to hear you talk this way because I think there's a lot of misinformation out there. One of the things that I like about your piece is it's not the federal government and bureaucracy solving this problem. It's entrepreneurs. It's small businesses. And so why hasn't the government been on board with something like this?
Well, there's two reasons. There is a cabal in Washington, where I live, that like the idea of oil and gas being limited. I mean, I don't like it. They believe it, let's say, and it fits with their worldview of running out of stuff. And there's they're running out of stuff. The end of the world way of thinking is not only still common in a lot of circles. It's been common for a long time. These are sort of apocalyptic way of thinking. Then there's another group who actually, I think this is the majority, who don't believe that this is a permanent revolution, a permanent change. They sort of think it's a discovery that's a bubble and it's going to go away. And they're worried about that. So I give them credit for the sense of worry because getting on board something that's just evanescent makes you nervous. I think the most important reason that we haven't had the government get on board, other than this sort of environmental opposition to and a hope for end of oil, is just that it's not fully absorbed into the system of thinking that we've gone from an era of 40 years now of worrying about being dependent on foreign oil, worrying about running out of oil, to now have to completely shift our thinking 180 degrees, where we live in an era where we have essentially unlimited supplies, we're never going to run out of it, and we could become an exporter. This is so different from what people have been told and thought about how legislation has been passed for 40 years. It just takes a little time. This legislation that's now moving through to end the ban on exports is a good example of it finally having the policymakers understand it's time.
Right, and there's such a shift in the thinking, like you said, that it's going to take some time for us to get there. Mark Mills, thank you so much for joining us and on the show and explaining this issue to us.
My pleasure. Have a great morning.
Yes, you too, and have a great Christmas.
Take care. Bye-bye.
It's 8:25. You're listening to Katie Hyde filling in on The Steve Gruber Show.
Genuine Michigan common sense on display every day.
Never before have I turned on you when you look too good to me. Your beady eyes that can cut me in two and I just can't let you be. But it's a free for all and a heart I said, you can bet your life. Stakes are high and so am I. It's in the air tonight.
It's 33 after the hour, and this hour brought to you by Mesa Good Health, Good Business, and Great Schools. I'm Michigan Talk Network's Katie Hyde, filling in on the Steve Gruber Show. And our next guest I'm very excited to talk to on the line is Matab Mahmoudi. She joins us. Matab, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Matab is the daughter represented in the film and the book, Not Without My Daughter. And it's the story of your family, Matab, your Iranian-born father and your American mother took a trip to Iran. Many of us probably remember the story. You went for what was a two-week vacation, and then when you got there, some plans changed. How much of that can you remember?
I remember quite a bit. I was young. I was four when we went and six when we escaped. So my memories aren't complete, but I remember quite a bit. And what I remember quite vividly.
And what are some of those? And I want to be respectful of your story as well, but we read the book or we see the movie, but what do you as a 4 and 5 year old girl remember about that time?
Well, I suppose starting with, you know, the day my dad told us that we couldn't come home, you know, from that day on, what stands out in my memory is the sound of his footsteps. I mean, he was so completely changed that even his footsteps sounded different, that I would hear him coming down the hall and his footsteps were just terrifying. You know, but it wasn't all bad either. There were a lot of people there who, you know, complete strangers who risked their lives to try to help us because they wanted us to know that all Iranians were not like my father and his family. And so it was these great extremes.
Matab, the story ends, or the credits roll on the film, and as viewers or readers, we get a happy ending, but life continued on for you. What was your life like after you got back here to the States?
Things didn't end for us quite so neatly as a movie ends. You know, we were always afraid my dad would come in and try to kidnap me and try to kill Mom. That's what he vowed he would do if we ever managed to escape. And so we implemented a lot of security precautions. We had security systems, and my mom carried a gun, and we didn't stay where we lived. As a child, when I played outside, I wore an alarm button around my neck, those kinds of things. But then I guess the extremes continued, because on the flip side, and despite living with these security measures, I had a very loving and happy childhood, too, after our escape, because there were so many adults in my life who were working so hard to keep me safe and give me as normal a childhood as possible.
You mentioned how the relationship with your father changed. How did the relationship with your mom change after you got back here?
Well, Mom and I were always very close, and we remain very close. She you know, she did an amazing thing. You know, after we came back, I was so angry and so filled with hatred toward my dad and toward anything that reminded me of him. And she recognized that hatred, and she understood how destructive that was in my life and how destructive it would be in my life growing up if it weren't addressed. And so she worked really hard to help me remember the good things about my dad and to really celebrate the good in the Persian culture that would always be mine. And so I give her a lot of credit for that. We're still very close.
And you have some Michigan ties, don't you?
I do. I was, mom was from Michigan originally, and I've lived most of my life in Michigan.
Yay.
And I'm a proud Spartan. Go Green.
All right. We love hearing that here, especially we're broadcasting in the Lansing area, so that's probably the best thing you could have said here today.
I bleed green, for sure.
That's wonderful. You know, you mentioned some of these things about your childhood and your growing up years. What do you do? You know, a lot of people say, like, I had this, you know, traumatic event or things go on and I just can't get past it. What did you do in order to grow up this healthy, vibrant young woman?
Well, I think forgiveness is the key and faith. You know, I think that God puts just the right people in our life at just the right times, and that he uses even the most difficult experience for good, and he can turn even the most difficult thing into a blessing in our lives. And I was really fortunate that after our escape, I ended up at a Lutheran elementary school in Owosso, not far from the Lansing area.
And, I know Owosso well.
And my teachers really, really nurtured me and took the time to teach me the importance of forgiveness and, you know, really showed me unconditional love and taught me about God's love and his protection. And so, you know, as I learned more about forgiveness and mom was helping me see the good in my dad and the heritage he gave me, it all sort of came together. And I'm so thankful to have had these people who really set aside their own emotions or feelings about the situation and helped me come to terms with it.
And it's always important to have a support system. You were very fortunate to have that. Mata Mahmoudi is on the line with me. Tell me what your life is like now and what you're doing.
Well, I feel like I'm sort of living in limbo right now. I had to leave my job. I was working in the mental health field, but doing mostly marketing, nothing clinical. And had to leave to write full-time. And so that was my life. And then I became really sick. I have lupus. And so for the past 2.5 years, my full-time job has been getting better.
And we certainly wish you well with that. I noticed that you are doing some speaking, and you'll be coming to the Saginaw area Saturday, January 23rd at 6 o'clock. You'll be at the Michigan Lutheran Seminary on Hardin Street in Saginaw. And how much speaking opportunities do you get?
I've been fortunate over the years. I've been invited to do a lot of speaking all over the world, and it's been a real honor to do that and meet fascinating people, and it's a lot of fun. I really enjoy that. So it's been on the back burner for the past couple of years because I haven't been up to it, but
absolutely.
Now, the invitations are coming in.
And speaking, I mean, you don't just get up there and talk. I know what that's like. It takes a lot of energy. And so you're right to take a break and take care of yourself.
Thank you. It does. It takes an amazing amount of energy and focus. And I've struggled with focus. We'll see. It's going to be an adventure, January 23rd. But it's my alma mater. And I'm excited to have the opportunity to go back and hopefully do something good for the school.
Matab, we need to wrap up. I understand your dad passed away in 2009. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
It is.
And what was, real quickly, what's your mother doing now, and how is everything that stands with your parents? How is everything with that?
Mom's great. We actually, she's going with me. I'm signing books in Alpena. Tomorrow. And so we're driving to Alpena this afternoon. And last night we were sewing together, and we spent a lot of time together. She's doing quite well.
That is wonderful. Mata'ab Mahmoudi, thank you so much for joining us. She'll be speaking in Saginaw on Saturday, January 23rd at 6 p.m. You'll want to check that out. Thank you so much, and Merry Christmas.
Thanks. Merry Christmas.
It's 8:41. I'm Katie Hyde from the Michigan Talk Network, filling in on the Steve Gruber Show.
Delivering Michigan common sense with a big dose of truth and honesty.
It's 8:45. I'm Katie Hyde, filling in on the Steve Gruber Show. And as we wrap up today, I'm thinking about Christmas. You probably are, too. All that you have left to do, the house that needs to get clean, the presents that need to get purchased and wrapped, and you probably have a lot going on. And so I was feeling nostalgic this week and looking ahead. And I looked up the original letter to the editor written by 8-year-old Virginia O'Hanlon. She wrote a letter to the editor to the New York Sun back in September of 1897. And her question and her response was printed there. The response was written by newsman Francis Church, and he has since become history's most reprinted newspaper editorial. And it's appeared in dozens of books and publications and languages. And here's what the original letter said, 8-year-old Virginia O'Hanlon. She says, "Dear editor, I am 8 years old. Some of my little friends say there is no Santa Claus. Papa says, if you see it in the sun, it's so. Please tell me the truth. Is there a Santa Claus? Virginia O'Hanlon." And Francis Church wrote her back, and he said this, "Dear Virginia, your little friends are wrong. They have been affected by the skepticism of a skeptical age. They do not believe except what they see. They think that nothing can be which is not comprehensible by their little minds. All minds, Virginia, whether they be men's or children's, are little. In this great universe of ours, man is a mere insect, an ant in his intellect, as compared with the boundless world about him, as measured by the intelligence capable of grasping the whole truth and knowledge." The editorial goes on. "Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. He exists as certainly as love and generosity and devotion exist, and you know they are abound and give your life its highest beauty and joy. Alas, how dreary would be the world if there was no Santa Claus. It would be as dreary as if there were no Virginias. There would be no childlike faith, no poetry, no romance to make tolerable this existence. We should have no enjoyment except in sense and sight. The eternal light in which childhood fills the world would be extinguished." Church continues, "Not believe in Santa Claus, you might as well not believe in fairies. You might get your papa to hire men to watch all the chimneys on Christmas Eve to catch Santa Claus. But even if they did not see Santa Claus coming down, what would that prove? Nobody sees Santa Claus, but that is no sign that there is no Santa Claus. The most real things in the world are those that neither children nor men can see. Did you ever see fairies dancing on the lawn? Of course not, but that's no proof that they are not there. Nobody can conceive or imagine all the wonders that are unseen and unseeable in the world. You may tear apart the baby's rattle and see what makes the noise inside, but there is a veil covering the unseen world, which not the strongest man, nor even the united strength of all the strongest men that ever lived, could tear apart. Only faith, fancy, poetry, love, and romance can push aside that curtain and view and picture the only supreme beauty and glory beyond. Is it all real? Ah, Virginia, in this world, there is nothing else real and abiding. No Santa Claus, thank God, he lives and he lives forever. 1,000 years from now, Virginia, nay, 10,000 years from now, he will continue to make glad the heart of childhood." And that's the famous editorial from the New York Sun, published back in September of 1897. That's the work of veteran newsman Francis Church. And obviously, Santa is a huge part of Christmas. I tell my kids he's a fun tradition. He's a magical part of the holidays, and he makes the holidays fun. And I was feeling nostalgic, and I was reading some articles. And there's the other reason why we celebrate Christmas as well. And I stumbled across an article, a blog by Jason Sorosky. He's a writer and musician. His blog says that he taps into his experiences not only as a worship pastor and teacher, but also as a husband and a father of five, and he published a work called Just Drop the Blanket. He writes, "This week, A Charlie Brown Christmas aired on national primetime television for the 50th time, and in a world where the latest, greatest technology is outdated in a matter of months, and social media trends come and go in a matter of days, 50 years is meaningful. I'm a fan of all things nostalgic and Christmas, and when the two combine, I'm hooked, and the Charlie Brown Christmas special falls squarely into that category. He says that he played Linus in the Charlie Brown Christmas play at school, and he was chosen to play the role of Linus. And so he had to memorize that passage in the Bible, Luke 2, which tells the Christmas story. And he says, while working diligently to learn those lines, there's one important thing I didn't notice then. I didn't notice until now, right in the middle of speaking, Linus drops the blanket. Linus has always been the one that's hung firmly to his blanket. And in this point of the play, he drops the blanket. It's that climactic scene where he shares what Christmas is all about. He drops a security blanket. And the writer goes on to say, I'm convinced this is intentional because it's the most telling and specific moment is when he drops it and he utters the words, fear not. And here's what Linus says.
Everything I do turns into a disaster. I guess I really don't know what Christmas is all about. Isn't there anyone who knows what Christmas is all about?
Sure, Charlie Brown. I can tell you what Christmas is all about. Lights, please. And there were in the same country shepherds, abiding in the field, keeping watch over their flock by night. And lo, the angel of the Lord came upon them. And the glory of the Lord shone round about them. And they were sore afraid. And the angel said unto them, fear not. For behold, I bring you tidings of great joy, which shall be to all people. For unto you is born this day in the city of David a Savior, which is Christ the Lord. And this shall be a sign unto you. You shall find the babe wrapped in swaddling clothes, lying in a manger. And suddenly there was with the angel a multitude of the heavenly host praising God, and saying, glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace, goodwill toward men. That's what Christmas is all about, Charlie Brown.
The writer goes on, looking at it now, it's pretty simple what Charles Schultz was trying to say, and it's brilliant. The birth of Jesus separates us from our fears. The birth of Jesus frees us from the habits we are unable or unwilling to break ourselves. The birth of Jesus allows us to simply drop the false security blanket, just like Linus, that we've been grasping so tightly, and learn to trust and cling to him instead. That is what Christmas is all about, Charlie Brown. You're listening to The Steve Gruber Show.